Welcome back. We're on our final item, IS 12. Thomas.
Thank you very much. At its meeting in December 2012, the ISB asked the IFRS Interpretation Committee to develop a recommendation for an amendment to IS 12 that clarifies the accounting for deferred tax assets for unrealized losses on debt instruments measured at fair value. At this time, the FASB was also about to expose proposals on the accounting for deferred tax assets for similar instruments as part of its financial instruments project. A key feature of the FASB's proposal was to require that the realization of deferred tax assets related to debt instruments measured at fair value through other comprehensive income is assessed separately from the realization of other deferred tax assets. This approach is different from the approach that is required in IS 12. The approach that is required in IS 12 requires a combined assessment of the realization of the deferred tax assets as specified by tax law. The ISB, considering these proposals, however, the ISB asked the Interpretations Committee to also consider whether a narrow scope amendment to IS 12 should achieve an outcome for in accounting for deferred tax assets that is consistent with the one that has been proposed by the FASB for similar instruments. The Interpretations Committee discussed the issue at its meetings in May 2013, January 2014, and consulted the ISB members in small group meetings in October 2013 before it decided at its meeting in March 2014 on the recommendation that is included in paragraph 14 of staff paper 12 for this ISB meeting. And this recommendation is based on the existing principles in IS 12. The recommendation of the Interpretations Committee reflects the approach that deferred tax assets for unrealized losses on debt instruments that are measured at fair value are recognized unless the entity is in what we call in a tax loss position. In a tax loss position means that the entity has insufficient probable future taxable profits to recognize deferred tax assets for all of its deductible temporary differences. In such a situation, the entity only recognizes deferred tax assets for unrealized losses on debt instruments measured at fair value to the extent that it can utilize the related deductible temporary differences as specified in paragraphs 24 to 31 of IS 12. The Interpretations Committee prefers this approach to an approach that achieves an accounting outcome for deferred taxes that is consistent with the one that has been proposed by the FASB for similar instruments, because it's not clear to the Interpretations Committee what economic benefit is embodied in the additional amount of deferred tax assets that are recognized in applying this alternative approach. Why and when this alternative approach results in the recognition of such additional amounts of deferred tax assets is illustrative in staff paper 12A for this meeting. In other words, the recommendation of the Interpretations Committee and its rejection of the alternative approach is not primarily based on conceptual reasons, it's primarily based on the conclusion that the recommended approach reflects economics appropriately. Furthermore, after the Interpretations Committee finalized its recommendation for the ISB and after the staff completed its work on staff papers 12 to 12C for this meeting, the FASB discussed the feedback that it had received on its proposal from last year and thereby also considered the recommendation of the Interpretations Committee for the ISB. On the basis of these discussions, the FASB reversed their previous decision. The FASB decided that the assessment of a valuation allowance for a deferred tax asset related to an available for sale debt security should be made in combination with the entity's other deferred tax assets. Consequently, we understand that the Interpretations Committee recommendation will not result in a gap difference that is specific for debt instruments measured at fair value through OCI. So we will only have the general differences that exist anyway. Finally, the Interpretations Committee proposes that the ISB publish a proposed amendment to IS 12 that mainly consists of an illustrative example that explains several aspects in the application of the existing principles in IS 12. In addition, the Interpretations Committee recommends an amendment to paragraph 29 of IS 12 to clarify the probable future taxable profit against which deductible temporary differences are assessed for utilization excludes the tax deductions represented by those deductible temporary differences. We want to ask the following questions to the ISB first. Do the ISB members have any questions on the discussions and recommendation of the Interpretations Committee? And secondly, does the ISB agree with the Interpretations Committee's conclusion and recommendation?
Are there any comments or questions?
I just had that. In terms of the transition here, I recognize this is an interpretation and a small amendment to IS 12, but it's intended that this would be effective as soon as we publish it. How does this work?
ED.
I know it's an ED, but I mean.
Yes, so we're proposing a narrow scope amendment. It would need to go through the exposure draft process, and we would bring back, if you were in agreement at this meeting, we'd bring back a due process paper at the next meeting, which would address things like transition, so that we could sort of specify that. And as for effective date, we would normally look to see that people had sufficient time for preparing for this, and also the endorsement bodies would have sufficient time as well for their work.
Are you anticipating that this would be a retrospective or modified retrospective, or how do you anticipate just a straight?
We'll bring a paper next time.
Have you thought through it, I guess, is my question. I know you're going to bring a paper, but.
I think we haven't come to any conclusion, you know. We have so far done a little bit of thinking about that, and what we are not sure about is the amendment would sort of might have result in changes, you know, how you allocate the amounts of deferred tax asset recognized in profit or loss and in other comprehensive income. And what we haven't done so far is the ED that was published in 2008 or 9 or so had specific transition requirements with respect to retrospective application on this issue, but we haven't been able to think that through whether this should result in a prospective or modified retrospective application or whether there's not an issue.
The reason why I raise it is because to some extent I guess you could say there's potential use of hindsight here. Because if you're looking at something that was underwater 3 years ago and now it effectively matured at a point in time that covers the transition period, you know, how do you deal with a situation like that? Or you just deal with it prospectively? I don't know.
Consider that in the paper.
Yeah.
Carol.
I agree with the IFRIC recommendations. I think that the interpretations, if you like, of the standard. And I agree with the content of the example. I've got no problem with either of those. I am concerned about the delivery mechanism that we're using in the process here. My understanding of the way the issue is at the moment is that there is diversity of practice, meaning people presumably in good faith are misinterpreting the wording of the standard in certain circumstances here. We've sought to resolve that problem to help people actually get there, by in one instance actually changing the standard, but for the other three instances where that misinterpretation is happening, by adding an illustrative example to the end of the standard. Now that seems to me that we're trying to resolve an issue in the standard, which is mandatory guidance, by adding non-mandatory guidance at the end of the standard. I think it would probably work here because there'd be enough sort of trumpets roaring about the fact that we'd issued this new illustrated example to reflect that. But I'm worried about what that says about the positioning of illustrated examples in our overall guidance. We're effectively expecting people to change their practice, change their interpretation of mandatory guidance by reading non-mandatory guidance, and I'm uncomfortable with that relationship, with that effect. We've had the chat though about it, so.
What's the alternative?
I think that the example or components of the example should probably be pulled into the standard itself, into the application guidance.
But if the standard will not be changed at all?
The problem is I don't think that's right. I think we need to change the standard. I don't think we can expect a change in practice to evolve from a change in illustrative guidance. It's pretty much like saying we expect a change in the interpretation of a standard to come from education material, from non-mandatory guidance that sits outside of the standard itself.
And what would be the problem if we change the standard instead of following the RELS recommendation? Is there a difficulty in doing that?
That is certainly possible. Now, we had these discussions with the Interpretations Committee, and the Interpretations Committee took the view on the other three items that they felt that giving this additional guidance in illustrative examples was sufficient. You know, of course there are other ways that that can be done, but they felt that the standard already required this. It's clear that it's not how people have understood the standard, which is why we need to do something. But for them, they felt that providing the illustrative examples would be sufficient to be able to communicate their view of the standard.
I think that will create some enforcement difficulties, because then the status is not very clear. We say they misinterpreted the standard, maybe in good faith. So correction should be a correction of error, theory. But we want to bring that through an example. And for enforcers, it becomes quite complex.
I think, you know, if we want to think so, we have exactly the same problem for any agenda decision, rejecting decision. You know, rejecting decision basically said the standard is clear, and we will not take into the agenda. And maybe describe something, say you should follow the standards. But all the words in the agenda decision, will you feel it is enough?
So the odd thing for me is I probably find an agenda decision more acceptable. Because if we were taking an agenda decision, we would say it's clear, go read the standard, you're reading it wrong. What we're saying by putting in an example is we're saying, okay, we acknowledge it's not clear. Mm. But then we're putting it in non-mandatory guidance, and it's that disconnect that worries me.
Stephen.
I agree with Daryl. I mean, how can we have transition requirements and an effective date, for an example?
We would have the transition requirements and effective date for the bit that is going into the standard.
I think that's one.
Which implies that the other bit is then an error.
No, I don't think that is necessary to conclude in that way. You know, if people have been reading the standard, as we say, in good faith, and people are then sort of given, you know, additional education material, they then learn better about the requirements of the standard. Previously they had read it as it could be interpreted more than one way. We've now, through education material, clarified that it only should be applied in one particular way. Then clearly they'd be amending their accounting policy on the basis of a better understanding of the requirements of the standard. And so that's a, you know, an education point.
They change now.
Hang on.
I guess I would have two concerns with that answer. I think in the first instance, I think that if I've learned something new because I didn't read the standard properly last time, or I didn't read, then that does seem to me like an error. But let's put that aside for the moment, because I'm not necessarily sure this is an error. I think this is an interpretation issue. The second thing, though, and it comes back to the point, is you're emphasizing that they need to use the educational material in order to understand what they were previously interpreting in good faith. And again, that seems to me that what we're doing is we're elevating that education material to mandatory guidance. Mm. We're saying that it's required to understand the standard. And I that's the disconnect that one that worries me.
Why good?
Whether we want to, you know, give guidance through interpretation or amendments is another issue we should discuss. But as to, you know, such kind of, you know, clarification or rejection decision or illustration, you know, I remember right after when Abdon took over the job, the IFRIC once discussed these issues and also discussed with the board, you know, whether it will trigger, you know, error or not. And I remember the IFRIC decisions, discussions and the discussion among board members basically say it's hard to say. And we also don't want to clearly say it is error or not, because it is truly judgmental. And my personal experience as previous regulator told me it is judgmental. In some cases, you know, it is purely, you know, clarification without any, for example, intentional misusing of our standards in the past. But in other cases, it obviously is an error in the past because some company or a group company intentionally misuse the standards. Okay. And so it's judgmental.
It's not about intention, that was it.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes intentionally.
Yeah, but even if it's unintentional, it can be an error. Right.
Mary.
I think Daryl's challenge consideration is the right one to raise, you know, remembering the non-authoritative status of an example. There's a but coming here. And what we've heard from the staff on this is that this issue was explicitly considered by the Interpretations Committee, you know, being aware that the example was non-authoritative. And the Interpretations Committee brings together, you know, several of the types of stakeholders that we have said might be stressed by this, including some enforcer representatives as well as auditors and preparers. Now, I think we have a bit more. I think Daryl is right to raise the challenge, and I think we should be very cautious about going the non-authoritative example route. Having already had the Interpretation Committee consider that concern explicitly, recognizing that this is an exposure draft, I am minded to take the recommendation of the Interpretation Committee on this point. You know, maybe we have to think about whether there's anything we put in the invitation to comment that accompanies this, about whether it would cause a problem, and go this way. But it's a reminder not to go, you know, to think hard before we go that route, and it probably does point to something we should consider, you know, in future. Although I think this is a legacy, issue more than a new one, because I think in the format that we use today, we'd probably be more likely to include some comment about this in application guidance, which is mandatory, rather than solely in an illustrative example. But we've inherited this, you know, we've adopted a standard from our predecessors. Mandatory standard, non-mandatory example. I don't think we should restructure, a standard to try and get there. So I'd say, let's go for the ED with the recommendation.
Would people be able to accept that on the basis this is an ED and we raise the issue?
I think we should, at a minimum, I think we need to raise the question.
Yeah.
I would doubt it.
So, your proposal, Daryl, would be what?
There are already existing examples in IAS 12, I think, in the application guidance component of OINE. And I would prefer to bring in some form of example into that space so it's part of the mandatory guidance. It doesn't need to be a long example. I think we can always then use illustrated examples to break it out into a much longer example. But I think at the very least, I think we need something in the mandatory guidance to point to.
You're right, we do have mandatory in here, sorry.
I hate to raise this, Michael, but if this was done as an interpretation, could you wrap it up into one document?
I suppose on the interpretation question, the reason why the committee have come back with this proposal is because the board has specifically asked it to prepare to recommend a narrow scope amendment in this case.
So they didn't consider whether they could do an interpretation?
No, they didn't. But to be honest, the sorts of things that we're looking at here
don't really fit. Yeah.
they don't naturally fit with an interpretation. Mm. Yeah, there's four distinct pieces here that we are clarifying.
Pretty complex too.
So what would your reaction be to Daryl's proposal?
We can obviously take pieces that we are illustrating here and put them either as additional sentences for clarification, giving clarification in the body, or perhaps a application example in the body of the standard. You know, there are four different points here that we've been looking at, one of which is already proposed to be in the body of the standard. The other three, at the moment, we have got as being in an illustrative example and explanations about how the conclusion was reached in the basis of conclusions. Those three points are in paragraph 14 of paper 12, and it's paragraph 14A, 14B, and 14C. Those are the three points that are being proposed for illustration in the illustrative example.
And which one's going into the standard?
D, 14D. Now on item number 14B, this was a point that when this had previously gone out as an annual improvement, the comment letters that came back led the Interpretations Committee to conclude that actually this was pretty well understood. So in which case, putting this into an illustrative example seemed to be all that was needed for this particular point. For the other two items, 14A and 14C, that's where, yes, additional guidance was clearly needed. Now, Thomas and I looked at this after we'd spoken with Daryl, and certainly 14A is something that, you know, could be fitted into an application example in the body of the standard.
Let's see.
With regards to C, now, this one was one where the Interpretations Committee did push back somewhat from an original staff proposal for including this in the body of the standard. Their concern there was that this could be misinterpreted when it comes to non-financial assets that are carried at fair value. This is the item about clarifying that when you are estimating your future taxable profits, it's appropriate to assume that the entity will recover those assets for more than carrying amount, provided that is probable. That's the normal test within IAS 12. Now, when it comes to financial assets that are carried at fair value, then you've got a contract that sets out what the cash flows are supposed to be. And so that's the basis on which the Interpretations Committee was concluding here. Yes, it's appropriate, assuming that you've got, you know, you're using your judgment in estimating what your future cash flows are going to be, and if you've concluded that this item is not impaired, then that's saying that you're expecting to receive those cash flows, then it's appropriate to assume that you will recover that financial asset for more than carrying amount. But their concern was perhaps more for non-financial items carried at fair value, so for example investment property, and whether perhaps more caution is required in assuming that you will recover that for more than carrying amount.
Maybe you can add, they were not saying that this conclusion in these guidance in this principle is wrong for this specific fact pattern. The only thing is, for investment property, it might quite likely be not probable that you recover it for the carrying amount because of the way you measure them. Whereas for other ones, in particular items that are measured at cost, On the other hand, it's they expect that it happens quite often that you, it's probable to recover them for more than a carrying amount.
What's the problem if it's not probable? If it's not probable, you don't recognize the taxes.
That would be right.
So why is that a problem? Why are investment properties a problem? I understand.
They concerned the way the discussion was that, you know, that people, as Michael said, understand it in a very broad way and might even assume in such cases that you recover it for their carrying amount when they estimate future taxable profits. That's the way they perceived it.
So I misunderstand probability.
That's implicit in the concept and the whole standard, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a different thing, really.
Which is one of the reasons for saying, you know, do we really need to be putting something into the body of the standard? It runs throughout the whole of the standard.
Well, I mean, on B and C, if what you say, if I understand what you say, you could argue, why are we putting it in at all? And B, you said, it's generally understood. And in C, you say it runs through the whole standard. So
my understanding of the reason why this was raised is that people are misinterpreting at least A and C. So there's diversity,
yes,
in practice on A and C, which means that the fact that it runs through the standard doesn't change the fact that people are misinterpreting or misreading.
Yeah, exactly. These were the issues identified from the comment letter analysis on the proposal and exposure draft, and that resulted, you know, to not address this issue in the annual improvements process, but to have a separate project on that.
Well, I'm quite keen in taking up something that Mary said earlier, that we don't bounce this one back. This is an ongoing problem, the Interpretations Committee, and I think it's perceived by them and by us. They've had a good go at it. They've worked it over carefully. We seem to have some disagreement, mainly in the placement of the examples, particularly on two of them. Sounds like B. Don't even know if we need an example. That wouldn't hurt, I suppose.
And just to clarify, the example that is we would be proposing is one that would integrate these, so it sort of shows the interrelationship, the interworking of these,
that's
and
great.
Just making sure that we are drawing out these aspects within that example.
I'm trying to think through your problem, Daryl, on the principle of, you know, having non-mandatory examples in effect becoming interpretations or...
Yeah. And I mean, I suppose if I were to phrase it a different way, if I pick up the standard in 2 years' time when this is in, and I choose not to look at the illustrative examples, I could presumably still reach the wrong decision. And that's my concern. So this says that I actually have to look at the illustrative examples. And I'm not sure I've heard anything that says differently to that.
And but the counter argument is, so you have to tell me again.
Yeah, the counter argument is that, you know, these are, I mean, let's not forget, deferred taxes is not straightforward. Okay, the standard is not the most straightforward of standards to apply. So, you know, It's not surprising that people read it and have applied it in different ways. So hence we've got the diversity of practice. What we've attempted to do here is to address that diversity in practice through illustration. To say, look, you know, here is the detail. And it's not that the detail is wrong or it says the wrong things. It says the right things. It's just that it's not the easiest of standards to work with. And so we're saying, well, let's put out an illustrative example that helps people apply the standard and understand what its requirements are.
But I don't think we disagree with that. There is disagreement with that. I think the disagreement is where you put the illustrative examples. And the counter argument I wanted to hear was why they couldn't go in
for the authoritative part of the standard.
And the particular illustrative example that we've got is several pages long.
I think to have this illustrative I think the illustrative example that we have discussed with the Interpretations Committee in the March meeting showed the extent of what it would have. And based on the comments from the Interpretations Committee members, it might even get longer. And therefore, I think it is too long for an application guidance example within the mandatory part of the standard. So if we add something, I think it's, it would be on explaining with respect to these certain issues, how the principle in the standard work, works in this more specific to that, and maybe, for example, whether I have a deductible temporary difference or not, to give an application example. But then, you know, to have this in the form, summarized form, again, in the illustrative example, in the non-mandatory part. There we can have such longer examples.
What if we had more questions?
I'm having difficulty following this conversation, because looking at IAS 12, in the body of 12, it has things that are called examples illustrating paragraphs. And then in volume 2, we have illustrative examples. So could you clarify for me what the status is of the examples illustrating particular paragraphs are within the body of IAS 12?
The mandatory.
That's why I...
When it was discussed at IFIC, was it specifically said that the example would go into the illustrative examples, or was it left open?
The proposal was that it goes to the part B, the non-mandatory examples, yes. And contrary to the mandatory parts of the standard.
Pat, to your point, I think that's why the suggestion I made earlier was that I thought that we could introduce small, perhaps simpler examples into the mandatory part to illustrate the very simple point, and then have the much longer, more useful, kind of almost case study type example that runs over 6 pages or whatever in the illustrator section. And that would give both parts. That would mean that if I'm having problems with the small example, I can go to the big example, but the small example would be sufficient to tell me that I'm probably doing it wrong now and I need to change it.
So if I understand that proposal, that would mean we accept your recommendations, except we'd add a couple of simple examples into the standard itself.
Yes.
Would that be acceptable?
Yeah, we can do it, and we can see what feedback we get back. I mean, you know, the Interpretations Committee was of the view that it wasn't necessary, but you know, Darrell raises a valid point about, you know, the what would cause people to change what they're doing today.
Why can't you just add some words to the standard along the lines of what you've got in this paragraph 14 to make the words absolutely clear and have a non-authoritative example? I mean, you've described it in a page.
Yes.
Yeah. Why can't you add a few sentences to these paragraphs in IS 12?
We could do that.
But if that is not easy way to add a sentence, or give an illustrated example first and give another example longer, and whether this means, you know, based on such a decision, it will be purely changes accounting principle. But if the judgment is, you know, obviously, you know, standard is right, apply the wrong way.
Yeah, but I think what I understood from Darrell was, you know, we want people to obviously change to how the Interpretations Committee is saying this should be applied, and by putting something into the body of the standard, it's directing people using the mandatory material to apply the standard in that way. Whereas if there wasn't anything in the standard on that particular point, so for example point A, then there wouldn't be anything obvious or evident within the body of the standard to say, you know, if you've not been doing it this way, you need to change.
Sure.
Was there an explicit discussion at the Interpretations Committee about whether it should be in mandatory authoritative or non-authoritative guidance in the merits of either, or was it more that it was proposed as an illustrative example and accepted as that?
First of all, we, based on the feedback that we received on the exposure draft, we proposed an approach to the Interpretations Committee that we first of all have an example that explains how it works, how IS-12 works, a comprehensive example, and in addition we only make changes to the standard where we think the guidance in the mandatory part of the standard is not sufficient. This was the approach that we proposed to the Interpretations Committee, and they were supportive of that, and they even thought that less amendments to the standard were needed than we proposed. It's
So some of these points, which are here for inclusion only in the illustrative example, some of them had been proposed initially as amendments to the standard, and the committee had said, no, that's not needed.
Wording amendments or an example in the standard? Well, I'm just worried whether people were sort of talking across purposes or not, because you could have examples in the body of 12 given its form versus in the non-authoritative part of 12, because we have both, as I've learned today. So I wonder whether...
I don't know.
I wasn't there, so I'm just.
You mightn't get an answer to that too, but
I just want.
Yeah, haven't we got? I haven't tested it, but I'm feeling that there's general consensus that if that we need something in the body of the standard, then we've got to.
I personally feel not only for this case we should be very careful, you know, on such kind of decision. That is, you know, in the future.
Yeah, but let's deal with this problem now.
But I think it's a general issue. You know, we should be very careful.
So we think there should be something in the body of the standard. We then can decide that it's a couple of extra sentences or a limited example.
Would a cross-reference to the example?
Well, that's what. Yeah, with the large example in the non-mandatory, but maybe a cross-reference. I don't know if that's. But even without the cross-reference, why could we leave it to the staff to have a look at whether they could incorporate a couple of simple examples, or it would work better to put a couple of sentences in rather than us deciding on the trot what's the best way to go. And then don't take it back to the Interpretations Committee. Bring it back here for us to have a look at. And see if we're happy to issue it as an exposure.
I mean, a question for you, I guess, and I guess it's a due process question. You've decided that you'd like these pieces in the body of the standard, and that's fine, we'll do that. In terms of whether they take the form of sentences or illustrative examples, isn't that drafting? And so do we need to bring it to a public meeting?
Yes.
Yes, to which?
Bring it back.
It is drafting.
Yes.
But we're going to have to approve the draft for issuance as an exposure draft.
We don't.
That's right. But normally we would do that offline as part of the balloting process.
Do the drafting offline.
So in essence, all you're doing is taking the existing words you proposed and remixing them.
We have a handful of alternative solutions. I think you must go home, analyze them, come back to this board in July, and give a solid answer on how to do this.
No, she said July.
If you're ready.
You may find it straightforward.
We do mistakes when we do this just like that. This is, it's a mess already.
No, but we're not answering Michael's question, which is...
But in this case, wouldn't it be easier, wouldn't it be better from a staff perspective for you to sort of lay out not the absolute final words, but at least in sort of concept plus what sentences would look like versus short examples, so that we can give you a more clear direction of what we think the ED should look like, so you don't have to faff around so much when you get to the drafting of the ED?
Yeah.
Yes.
So bring back it.
And you'd like that at
next meeting?
Court meeting.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
You have to come back. Why don't you do it in contingency? conjunction with the due process paper.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to come back on that.
In case they have to go back to interpretation committee, why?
I was just going to say, but overall, I think people are supportive of the direction of, you know, the conclusions reached, and that they're the ones.
We're just talking about the format how we do it.
That's right.
So if you wish to communicate back to the interpretations committee, we haven't overturned the original date. Looking at how it's going to be presented. Okay.
Don't we have to vote on that?
Oh.
We can vote.
All right, who's in favour of that?
What are we in favour of?
I'm in favour of a good solution.
I think we've got 15.
14 out of 15.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, meeting closed.